Morning, everyone. I'm excited to be here at USENIX to tell you about our latest work, authenticating phone calls. I'm Brad Reeves, and this is joint work with my colleagues at the University of Florida, Logan Blue and Patrick Trainer. So I want to start out by pointing out that we really trust telephones as a society, especially as a backup and trusted platform when other things go wrong. So for example, when you lose access to an account, many times you'll have to call companies to have them reset a password. But it goes deeper than that. When the internet goes down, especially between two peering networks, network operators have no other option but to pick up the phone to call each other and coordinate a response. And this is also true in critical infrastructure. So when there is an anomaly in the power grid that can't be dealt with automatically, power plant operators have to pick up the phone and call each other, even though they may not have ever met, in order to keep the power on. Now, we should all be concerned about this because phones are not the most trustworthy network. So for an example, I've got two calls here on this slide. One of these is from Bank of America, and the other is from a phishing group in Europe. Now, can anyone in this room distinguish which is which? I didn't think so. In fact, I can't tell, and in general, neither carriers nor end users can provide any guarantees about who is on a call. Not even your carrier can tell the difference. And as a consequence, faking caller ID is really easy. In fact, there's even apps for this. And so, what's at the root of this problem? Why is this the case? Why is this so easy? And it has to do with the way that we've built the phone network. And so to really identify the features of the phone network that are relevant to this problem, let's take a look at a phone call when Bank of America calls me, for example. So Bank of America may make a call to me from a VoIP-based call center. Their call is going to be delivered to their VoIP carrier into an intermediate, kind of like a long-distance provider network, finally to my cellular provider, and then finally to my phone. Now, let's look at what happens along the way. So, the most important thing that's happening for the purposes of this talk is that identity is asserted, not attested, at every network boundary. So, when the call leaves the VoIP carrier and goes into the long-distance network, the VoIP carrier says, this is a call from a phone number belonging to Bank of America. And the long-distance carrier has no way of actually affirming that this is actually the origin of the call. So what this means is that, effectively, we can't have authentication of ID in this network. Second thing that happens is that the signaling protocols change. So these networks are, not only can they not ask each other about identity in a strong way, they're not even speaking the same language. And so what this means is that this problem of identity is really, really hard. Now, and the third thing that happens for the purposes of this talk is that the way the audio is represented digitally, especially in terms of how the audio is compressed, often changes at network boundaries. And this is going to be important later on in the talk. Now, one key idea I want you to take from this slide is that all of these networks are able to transmit voice end-to-end, but otherwise, they effectively share no other way of transmitting data end-to-end. So between Bank of America and my phone, the only thing that is transferred and delivered reliably is the call audio itself. Now, this isn't the first network that we've ever looked at that had authentication problems. We saw this in the early days of the web. And the fine folks at Netscape and some others developed the Secure Sockets layer, now known as TLS, to deal with this problem. Now, TLS, of course, doesn't solve all authentication problems. In particular, when you visit Amazon.com, you're using TLS to authenticate Amazon, but Amazon doesn't necessarily use TLS to authenticate you. Nevertheless, TLS has been a wild success in that it's made cryptographic verification of well-known parties commonplace. And so in this paper, we're aiming to bring end-to-end explicit authentication to phone calls, much in the same way that TLS brought authentication of well-known parties to the web. And the system that we've built is called Authloop. And the question the system answers is, can we get some guarantee that the real Bank of America, for example, is calling? So Authloop authenticates calls cryptographically and end-to-end for the existing phone network through the voice channel. So this is a long sentence, so let's unpack it. So by authenticating calls, we mean that Authloop provides strong identity claims for every call made between two parties. It does so cryptographically using strong cryptography, not heuristics or shared knowledge, things like having to play 20 questions when you pick up the phone. It does so end-to-end, making the phones themselves the authenticating parties, not the network. And it does so with the existing phone network, so it can be used with all telephones, landline, cellular, and VoIP. And it does so using the call audio, not the signaling channels that are often lost between networks. And so what this means is that this Authloop is reverse compatible and network agnostic, so no changes have to be made to the existing phone network for Authloop. Now, I do want to contrast this with one other solution that many people use. There are apps like ZPhone or Signal that provide authenticated end-to-end VoIP calls. But these are VoIP only, and you cannot use these apps to make calls to users that aren't using those particular systems. So to build Authloop, we had to solve two big problems. The first of which is how to actually send data through the voice channel to conduct a cryptographic handshake. The second of these is how to ensure a secure, efficient authentication protocol for that channel. Now let's look at the first channel, the first problem, sending data through the voice channel. Now most of you, at some point in your life, have used something that looks like this, a voice modem. These systems were great for the time in which they were used, but they're not sufficient for modern telephone systems. Because modern telephone systems, the one that we nearly all of us use every day, are typically VoIP or cellular, and they heavily compress the call audio. And so this presents a problem for transmitting data. And so let's take a look why. It's because these codecs that are used to compress the audio are heavily optimized for voice, not for any other kind of data. And so to reduce the bandwidth of the channel, they throw out anything that's unlikely to be related to voice. And so trying to send anything that doesn't look like a voice sounds awful. And so I've got a couple of examples for you. This first one, I'm going to play a little bit of audio. And if you've ever been stuck on hold, this is going to sound familiar. So this is a guitar just strumming a couple of chords. Now, let's listen to what happens when we encode it with AMR narrowband, one of the most popular cellular codecs. Sound familiar? I hope I didn't give anybody a little anxiety there. But we can see that, you see that how anything that isn't voice is terribly distorted. And this has significant implications for trying to actually send data over the voice channel. So I've got another graphic example here. What we've done in the top graph is sweep across the frequency band from 300 to 3300 hertz. So these are all the frequencies that phone systems are supposed to support. And then we've encoded it using AMR narrowband. As you can see, the beginning and end of the audio is clipped. It cuts out in the middle. The amplitude changes erratically. And what you can't see from this view is that both the frequency and phase information is also heavily distorted. And so what this means is that nearly all of the techniques that were developed by voice modem engineers over decades go out the window, because amplitude isn't preserved, phases information is lost, and frequency is distorted. So how are we going to send data through these awful channels? And the solution is to encode data as changes in frequency. So we represent data using one of three frequencies, 1, 2, and 3 kHz, and encode zeros and ones as an increase or decrease in these frequencies. Because we've only got a few of these, we have to use a Manchester encoding to make sure to limit run lengths, and that cuts down on our bandwidth. And we also have to do things like transmitting constant frequency headers to deal with things like VAD, if you know what that is. But the punchline of all this is that we can give it approximately 500 bits per second good put in the best case. That's only 500 bits. If you want to send a text message, it's going to take a few seconds. And so we evaluated our modem, and we sent 100 frames containing 2,000 bits each. That's bigger than the largest message that we needed for off-loop. And we tested it across landline, cellular, and VoIP codecs. And what we found was that our average bit error was between 0 and 0.5%. Now, for the channel that we're working for and the data rates that we're able to achieve, this is actually pretty good. But students of networking will know that where you have bit errors, you require a good link layer to help you deal with them. And unfortunately, we couldn't pull anything off the shelf because we can't use common tricks like headers or using sequence numbers or using long checksums because we just don't have the bandwidth at 500 bits per second. And so what we do is we actually take each frame, break it into 32-bit blocks containing 29 bits of data and a short 3-bit CRC. And we did a lot of math to find the optimal value of these parameters, by the way. And we send and acknowledge each block explicitly and retransmit each of these little blocks until the full frame is recovered at the end. Now, because we're using very short CRCs, there's about a 1.3% chance per frame that the layer 2 won't detect a bit error. Now, we did the math, and it turns out that if you're working in a call center 40 hours a week, this is going to affect you about once every 2 weeks. So it's not going to be a major problem for the adoption of the system. Now, this link layer, because we retransmit until a frame is completely received, is heavily dependent on the bit error rate. But fortunately, the performance is good for the error rates that we see in practice. So for the typical error rates that we're working with, we get a little under our optimal value of 400 bits or 500 bits per second. So now that we've got a way of sending data through the channel, I told you that what we wanted was something like TLS for the phone network. So why don't we just use TLS? And the answer is that trying to do TLS in this channel is going to be way too slow. So we took a look at some representative TLS handshakes from common websites, and it turns out that in the best case, you'd be looking at an average of a 97-second authentication. I don't know about you, but I'm completely unwilling to wait a minute and a half to authenticate a phone call. So what we need is a protocol with the guarantees of TLS 1.2, but a fraction of the bandwidth requirement. So we took TLS and slimmed it down, and we started by acknowledging the things that we absolutely needed. So, and the first of which is cryptographic attestation of identity, because that's the whole point of off-loop. Now, because we're doing this in a situation where, for example, landlines may not have access to an auxiliary data channel, we need a way to certify identity of new parties in band. And so what that's going to that makes necessary a PKI. And we're going to talk about what a PKI in this situation or in this scenario is going to look like towards the end of this talk. The second thing that we need are tests for freshness and liveness. Now, by freshness, we're of course referring to protection against things like replay attacks. Liveness, though, is a bit unique for this scenario, because what we want to ensure is that when you authenticate a phone call, you can actually ensure that as the call progresses, you're still communicating with the party that you originally authenticated with. Even, for example, if you call a call center and they happen to transfer you to a different apartment, which happens often, as we all know. The third thing that we need is a shared secret establishment. And there's a few reasons for this. One reason is that it helps with our liveness tests, but it also gives us some additional features. So right now, users are often accustomed, when they call a phone number, to sometimes entering a PIN to authenticate. And what this allows us to do is actually send small amounts of sensitive data, things like a PIN, or perhaps a social security number, encrypted through the voice channel. So off-loop would enable applications, for example, of you being able to send sensitive data to a call center without the call center representative having access to it. Now, of course, we can't have everything, and so there's some things that we have to live without. The first of which is RSA in favor of elliptic curve cryptography. And we also truncate our HMAX to reduce transmission time. Now, we checked with the NIST standards, and we found that 80 bits was going to be sufficient for this application. Second thing we had to live without was cipher agreement as a handshake step. Instead, we choose safe defaults and use version numbers in case we need to use stronger cryptography in the future. And the third thing that we do away with is things like the TLS record protocol. So if you're not familiar with the details of TLS, it actually has its own sort of application layer protocol for handling messages between the socket layers. So if you're familiar with the heartbeat message, it's transmitted using a record protocol. And that's just something that we don't need for our application. So let's take a look at the protocol we settled on. And this is this protocol is based on TLS 1.2 key transport. So if you're familiar with TLS, this is going to feel very familiar. We did verify this new protocol with ProVerif. And so our setting is after a call is initiated, we have two parties. We term one the verifier and the other the prover. And in this setting, the prover is authenticating to the verifier. So for example, a prover might be a call center. So in the first two messages, the prover and verifier both exchange nonces and identities, and then the prover also sends a certificate. In the third message, the verifier generates a pre-master secret based on the nonces, and sends that using the public key in the prover's certificate. It also uses the newly established session key to authenticate the first two messages. And then in the final message, the call center, or prover, rather, responds with a MAC with the new key that only someone in possession of the private key under which the pre-master secret was sent could actually generate, and authenticates the first two messages. So at this point, the handshake is complete, the prover is authenticated, and we've established a secret key, all of the goals that we discussed in the previous slide, except for one, and that is freshness, or liveness, rather. So to maintain liveness in the protocol, we send periodic keep alive messages, and these are just an HMAC of an incrementing nonce using the shared secret. Now, these are going to be very short, a fraction of a second, and so they can be sent during natural pauses in conversation. So this is great, but how well does it work? Well, on average, it takes us 9 seconds to do a full handshake, but if we're authenticating with a partner that we've already established a certificate for, we can cache the certificate and do it in about 5 seconds. And so what this means is that we've reduced the time to authenticate from the original 97 seconds down to somewhere between 5 and 9 seconds. So, and I do want to point out that network transmission accounts for 99% of this time. There's only really about 50 milliseconds of computation happening in these numbers. So I did promise to talk about more about the fact that we're proposing a certificate infrastructure. Now, one of the reasons that the PKI for TLS can be a bit thorny at times is because certificate authorities are not in charge of actual identities like domains or IP addresses. And so we actually think that the telephone system lends itself well to a model similar to our PKI. And so the idea is that the national or international body that establishes blocks of phone numbers, in North America that's an organization called NANPA, can act as a route and establish carriers as certificate authorities. And this has a number of advantages. First of all, the carriers not only manage numbers, they have to authenticate their customers when accounts are created. And they also maintain a billing relationship. So they have an ongoing connection to their customers and are in a strong position to actually definitively say that a particular phone number is owned by a particular entity. Now, something else that's nice is that these blocks of public numbers are known publicly. They're in a public database, which carrier controls which number. And so as a result, when we see a phone number, we can know which certificate authority or carrier we expect to actually be signing the certificate for the call that we're receiving. Now, we did the math, and it turns out that we could easily store certificates for all of the carriers in the United States in a small amount of space, about 100K. And so what this means is that in Authloop, if we use a PKI similar to the one we're proposing here, we actually don't need long certificate chains, just the certificate for the prover. And so, to sum up, telephones are used for our most trusted communications, but as we saw at the beginning, we can't be sure who's calling. Now, Authloop solves this problem by providing end-to-end cryptographic authentication of phone calls through the voice channel. And so what this means is that when Bank of America calls, we can know it's the bank and not the fishers. And so with that, thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to take your questions.
Hi, thanks. I'm Seer, seeking positions beginning fall 2017. As it happens, we're always hiring at Waterloo. So,
that's
anyway.
That's fantastic.
Anyway, I have two quick questions. So, one, the cert chains you have, can you just flip back to mm-hmm. that slide picturing? That one.
Right here,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, so while carriers are assigned blocks, as of like 10 years ago, right, there was number portability, and that introduces a quite complicated redirection system where you have in the cellular model, you have the home location register and the visitor mm-hmm. location register. How does that all work?
What a great question. And this is something that we actually had a lively discussion about this last night, because there's a couple of ways that you could handle portability. The first point I want to make is that even though numbers are ported, so for example, I actually have a ported number. I use T-Mobile now, but I have an AT&T phone number. Even though my phone number, even though my carrier is T-Mobile, it's AT&T who's actually responsible for administering my phone number. So the simplest answer would be to do something like AT&T would still be my certificate authority, even though I have a T-Mobile phone and that's who I pay for service.
But you said the important part is that there's mm-hmm. a billing relationship, which is no longer there.
Right, and so that would put a little bit of administrative onus, because you might have to deal with two parties. An alternative model that I've thought about is that you could actually have the owner of the block perhaps staple the certificate. So I might have a certificate issued by my current carrier, T-Mobile. And T-Mobile, when they issue the certificate, would go to AT&T and say, yes, T-Mobile is currently administering this number. And so you could handle number portability offline. Thirdly, this issue of portability is just a nice, it's kind of a little extra. Because if you can trust the carriers to act as certificate authorities, if you actually trust them, then this is not the most critical part of the protocol.
Right, right. Okay, the other question is how, so you need software at both ends, right?
Yes.
So this isn't gonna work with a Bakelite phone.
Right? So the Bakelite phone is not, my grandmother has one. I'm trying to get her to give it to me, actually. so out of the box, it's the Bakelite phone is not gonna work. Now, there's a lot of deployment models, and we discussed this extensively in the paper, I just didn't have time in the talk. One deployment model is perhaps creating a separate dongle that you just attach to the phone. So this might go on the handset cable, or in a mobile scenario, you might actually have a little Bluetooth dongle that just sits in your pocket and handles all of the audio communication when the time comes.
Mm, okay.
Because all you need for this is access to the voice channel.
Right, so like the old caller ID boxes that
exactly.
you would put in line would now just authenticate when it shows up.
Exactly, it would be exactly something like that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for the question.
Algis Rudis, Google. I'm curious, since the actual voice isn't encrypted, so it's not part of the cryptographic trends
mm-hmm.
link, is there a possibility for a fisher to contact you and forward all the cryptographic protocol part to Bank of America for authentication?
So this is a great question, and we do discuss this extensively in the paper, this particular threat model. The fact that this protocol does not authenticate the content of the call. It's something we're looking at in future work. But to answer your question directly, it would be very difficult because of our liveness test. The fact that it's expected that that you'll be able to continually authenticate the other end, even though you don't necessarily authenticate the call content. The fact that they're still on the line is important. And so if, for example, a Fisher were doing something like a three-way call, they would have to do a lot of gymnastics in the phone network to make an attack like that work.
Thanks. Very great talk. The question I have is that the phone itself, when I talk over voice, it probably has a channel of like 19.2 or 38.4 or something to its base tower.
It's going to depend on your carrier, the particular tower, and the phase of the moon. But the upper bound is usually around 13K.
For voice channel.
For the voice, unless you're talking HD voice, and then it's a little higher. But like I said,
okay.
It depends.
So the question I have is that, like, information theory tells us that you should be able to encode at the same rate of capacity, and you guys are only pulling 500 BPS. And so I'm wondering where's the gap, and perhaps you could use, you know, just more standard protocols if you had a larger capacity channel.
So that's a great question, and this is if we had an arbitrary capacity voice channel, if all cell phones were landline quality, this would have been a much easier paper to write. But your question, sort of the information theoretic limits, there's a couple of things. First of which, if we wanted to sort of exploit the information theoretic limits, we would have to first know the channel entirely. So if you and I were making a phone call to each other on the same tower using the same codec, something like that might be possible. But if I'm calling my bank and I don't know the type of endpoint they have, much less the particular codecs, the configurations, many of these codecs have lots of options that can have a vast effect on this. The reason that our modem is so far below Shannon is because we have to be agnostic to the network. So I hope that answers your question.
All right, let's thank Brad one more time.